Welcome to Hometown to Hollywood. This is Bonnie Wallace, author of The Hollywood Parents Guide, and today my guest is Molly Kay, founder of B Major Music. Molly has spent the greater part of her career working for various publishing companies in Paris, New York, and Los Angeles. She also spent 5 years working in A&R for Columbia, Warner Brothers, and Mercury Records before founding B Major Music. Molly has experience in every creative facet of music publishing, from songwriter development to catalog exploitation and film and TV to artist relations, and she's the perfect person to talk with to learn more about how the music industry actually works. Molly, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Bonnie. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
So you and I first met when Dove was 16, and her then manager brought you to a show choir concert to hear her sing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that a normal way for you to find young talent? How do you normally find talent?
Well, no, it's not a normal way for me to find young talent. I think it's the only way I've ever found young talent. And it was quite exciting. First of all, can I say where we were?
Yeah.
We were at Burbank High, and I had no idea that their production facility was going to be so extensive. And the performance and the production of the performance was pretty fantastic and pretty eye-opening. And it was the graduating class that was performing, right?
It was the top show choir.
Top show choir. Okay, so Dove had a little part.
Mm-hmm. And she had a solo.
I saw her for a little second, and mm-hmm. I thought, okay, it's great. And then when I met her afterwards, she had a lot of makeup on. Couldn't really see her much. We had a little quick interaction. But then Bonnie and her then manager brought Dove over to my house. And my very first impression of her to this day was, wow, she put herself together great. Oh my gosh, she's 16 years old, head to toe. Pow. Thought about it. Great job. And then, as she was sitting on my hardwood floor, she brought her little iPad pod speaker thingy and just started playing music and started singing along to her favorite songs, talking about every song, singing, talking. And I'm sitting on the couch looking at her going, oh my gosh, this girl is special. So that has never happened to me before in quite that way. After that, I thought, I'm going to send her to a friend of mine who is a very successful vocal instructor here in LA. He works with a lot of young talent. And then he works with artists like Bette Midler and Kristen Chenoweth. So I thought, hey, Eric Vitro, can you spend a little time with this young woman? Tell me what you think. And as she was walking out the door, he called me and said, sign her up. Oh, my God, she's fantastic. The talent, the aura, the everything, the charisma, the smarts, everything. So
that's how that happened.
That's how that happened.
And how do you normally find talent?
How I normally find talent is just through my industry friends, my industry partners, the people that I work with, the songwriters and producers that I represent, the artists that I represent, my manager friends, once in a while a lawyer friend. People just make recommendations and they see someone or they hear someone and they say, you've got to check this out. I don't see too much live talent so much anymore as I used to, but so predominantly it's just my circle of professional friends.
So word of mouth, direct recommendations from the industry.
Yeah.
So you represent music writers
mm-hmm.
and artists
mm-hmm.
and producers.
Mm-hmm.
What makes you decide that you want to represent someone?
First and foremost, I have to think they're really, 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 really talented. Like the talent is just flowing, overflowing, and exciting. And then I want to like them as people. I spent a lot of years working at publishing companies and record companies with various different executives and people that you would have to see every day that you didn't get to choose. And there were, at every one of those companies, small or large, there was always someone that I had to see every day that if I never saw them in my whole life, I wouldn't miss them.
That's a kind way to put it, probably.
So I thought, when I start my business, everyone I represent, I have to believe in them to my core. Because you get so many, you typically have so many disappointments that you have to endure. You get so many passes. You get so much negative feedback that you have to believe in order to get beyond it and get them to that next place. So the talent is first and foremost. And then the second criteria is, now that you can see who's calling you on the phone and you couldn't 20 years ago, when you see the caller ID, you go, oh, great, it's... You don't go, oh, no, it's...
That's a good litmus test.
Yeah. Oh, good. I never want to have a client, and I don't have any clients, that when they call, I have a feeling.
It's always sinks. Yeah,
there's no heart sinking. So those are like the two basic fundamental criteria.
Do you represent more music writers, songwriters, or more artists, or more producers? How does that shake out for you?
The shakeout for me is all of them are songwriters, every one of them. And then some of them are songwriter producers, two of them are songwriter artists, and all of them wear many hats. None of them do one job. Every one of them does a half a dozen or more jobs. One of my writer producers, for example, is an arranger, a writer, a producer, of course a musician, a multi-instrumentalist, a mixer, and sometimes even a mastering producer as well. So the more hats you can wear, Dove Cameron, for example, songwriter, singer, actor, and then I don't know how many other things she incorporates into who she is and what she does, but I don't have one person, and I don't think in today's challenging environment you can do one thing and get away with it. I think a long time ago as a songwriter, you could only be a songwriter. I only know one, and that's Diane Warren. That's all she does. But I don't know many people that
She's also at the top of her game.
She's at the top of her game. She just turned 60, and she would be fine with the world knowing that. She's had her 60th birthday. But she started during a time where you could do one thing and do one thing brilliantly, and that's all. Nowadays, I think it's becoming more and more difficult to be able to just get by with one talent.
Why do you think that is? That's interesting. Because I agree with you. It's clearly the case that you have to be a multi-talented person to have a chance in the music industry.
I think part of the reason, as a songwriter producer, a long time ago, you needed a lot of equipment, you needed a studio, you needed to have several people to do one job. Now, because of technology, you can create music and be one person and do many things. So the competition just keeps getting pushed into that. If I can only sing, I need to hire somebody to record me. I need to hire someone to mix me. So if you have the ability to play an instrument, and also if you can sing and record yourself, the more efficient you are and the more opportunity you create for yourself.
And maybe write and maybe produce and all that.
Yeah.
So...
Oh, Dove dances a little too, we know,
She's getting better all the time.
She does,
actually. I'm not sure anyone would hire her as a dancer, but the dance is starting to become something she gets paid to do.
Yeah.
In the course of being an actor and singer, which is cool. That's funny. So part of your resume includes the term A&R.
Right.
And what does A&R mean exactly?
Well, A&R is an old phrase, and gosh, I think it started maybe in the 50s, maybe even in the 40s, and it just legitimately stands for artists and repertoire. A&R. Artists and their repertoire. So basically, when I did A&R, and I still do it with... not so much with Dove and Ryan and the Girl and the Dreamcatcher, because they are very self-sufficient and they are visionary young people who really know what they want. But quite often, and still to this very day, A&R people who predominantly work at record companies, they find talent, they sign talent, and then it's their job to basically find the repertoire. If the artist isn't a songwriter, one example, well, he is a little bit now, Michael Bublé. Who's an artist that doesn't write at all nowadays? There's got to be somebody.
But you're right. Like there are artists out there who don't write, but very few.
Very, very, very few. So even if they do write, it's the A&R person's job to find collaborators for them, find other songwriters for them to write with, find producers for them to write with and to produce the album. And the A&R person signs the talent, creates the music by finding the songwriter, producer, creative people to collaborate, create the repertoire, and then oversee the recording of the music, and then the A&R job moves into handling after the record is done at the label, dealing with the marketing company, dealing with the promotion, the marketing department, the promotion department, all the various departments that help take that music and get it out to the marketplace and hopefully have hit records and sell records and things like that. So an A&R person has quite a broad scope of responsibility.
So your background in A&R was a pretty amazingly perfect background for someone who decided to strike out on their own.
Yes.
And do all of these things.
Yes.
as a one-person shop.
Yeah, it was great experience. I mean, my first job doing A&R kind of fell out of the sky, and it was a job that I literally had to pinch myself to ask myself, is this real? I had been in publishing for all of my career. And Josh Groban, at the time, who didn't write any of his own material, maybe one song, kind of co-wrote a little bit, predominantly songwriters wrote for him. His A&R person, he kind of fired her. And there was nobody at Warner Brothers Records that was appropriate. So his manager called me because I was a publisher at the time, and I knew all the A&R people at all the various labels. So he called me up and he wanted to have a meeting and he wanted to find out who I thought would be a great A&R person for Josh Groban. His manager was just as impatient and quick as you could possibly be. He had no time for a breath. He would say what he wanted to say and get off the phone and you'd be like, oh, I just had a conversation with Josh's manager. Okay, that's done. In this particular case, he was on the phone with me for almost 30 minutes. Describing the type of A&R person that they were looking for. I hung up the phone and coincidentally was a fan of Josh Groban's. The first CD I got was in a blank cardboard sleeve. Nothing on it but his name. I got 20 of those a week. I pop it in the CD player in the car and was floored. I'd never heard anything quite like it. Nobody had. It didn't exist before Josh Groban. And that CD and his subsequent next one, every time I was tired of hearing demos or the radio or whatever, I'd pop in Josh just to factor. So when I had that long conversation with his impatient manager, I thought, oh my God, I could be this person with no experience at all, particularly in A&R. So I stayed up till 2 in the morning. And I did all my research online, websites, searching, blah, 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 everything. Every song I listened to again, saw who wrote every song, who produced. David Foster was his producer at the time. And went into that meeting the next day and met with his manager. And that meeting was 2 hours long, and he hired me. Oh, by the way, I had 11 A&R recommendations.
Wow.
This guy who's done this, that gal who's done that, blah-de-blah. And I got the job. So that was kind of neat and scary.
Yeah.
And it was, Josh had sold 7 million records on his second album.
Oh my God.
So I was like stepping into that, those shoes. So it was really scary, but at the same time, Josh was very expressive, creative, musical, intelligent, knew what he wanted, and he was my teacher, really. It was me and him. We didn't have to deal with anybody at the record company because he had already sold 12 million records. His last one was 7. His first one, I think, was 5. So he was able to do whatever he wanted. So it was just me and him. And scary and great. And the first song that I brought him 3 months after we started working together, I had found the song. There was one part of it that was great. The rest of it was like, ugh, this is not going to work. I called the publisher, the music publisher who represented the songwriter, and I said, hey, who's the guy who wrote this song and what's the story behind the song? Can I meet him? Who is he? Oh, he's from Toronto. Cool. Okay, let's get on the phone. So I get on the phone with the songwriter and I say, so this song is beautiful. What's the story behind it? And he says, well, it was a really dark period of my life. I wrote the song, my wife and I had broken up and there was no light and that's what the song is about, but we got back together. And that song means so much to me. It is that period that we got through, and I was like, oh my God.
I can't ask you to change the song.
So I said to him, I said, all right, Togs, that song will never go away. It will always be there for you. Whenever you need to go back to it, it will be there. But
in its original form for you.
In its original form for you. But I think this could be the first single off Josh Groban's third album. Can we work on it together? And we did. And we rearranged it, and he rewrote, and blah, blah, blah. And I drive to Josh's apartment going, okay, if he hates this song because I believe in it so much and I think this is what he wants, I will resign because I'm the wrong person. But if he loves it, we're golden. And he loved it, and I kept my job, and the songwriter was very happy, and the songwriter's been on every album since. And there's a little A&R stuff for you.
So it sounds like you're an A&R person, and also, you know, I don't know that you would call yourself A&R anymore because you...
Not so much.
...are a music manager, really, for these different stripes of music talents. But it sounds like you're almost a matchmaker. And in my experience with what you've done for Dove and for Dove and Ryan together and The Girl and the Dreamcatcher, you bring artists together to create stuff.
Yes.
You know, songwriters and performers and producers.
Yes.
And they're all different cats, usually.
Yeah.
And the combinations can be really magical or really impossible.
Yes. I introduced Dove to an impossible one. And then I introduced Dove to a perfect one.
Only one impossible one.
We had one that didn't work, and you don't know. You never know. And personalities, talent, experience, credit, all that goes into a pile. And then the two personalities get together and chemistry happens.
It's chemistry.
Yeah. So and you try to get a sense of whether you think it's going to work or not. And most of the time, it does. And sometimes it doesn't. But that is part of the job too, having a people sensibility as well as a musical sensibility, those two together.
So much. I will never forget when Dove met Paula Winger and you put them together.
Yeah.
And I think at that point, Dove might have been 17, maybe. She might have still been 16.
Yeah, maybe.
She might have still been 16, but they met. And, you know, Paula's, you know, not quite my age, but you know, definitely an adult woman, you know, old enough to be Dove's mom. And they were like kindred spirits.
Yeah.
They were dancing together. They were playing and singing together. And it was so amazing to see, like, wow, the connection that they had. And they've gone on to create all kinds of stuff together.
Yeah.
Paula's co-written
every song except for Someone You Like.
Yeah. Just about everything
with
Dove
the
and The Girl and the Dreamcatcher.
To Liv and Maddie
as well. Which is a crazy coincidence.
That's a crazy coincidence. Yeah. And for all of you out there who may think, oh, well, Molly had Dove Cameron and we pulled some strings. We did not. We were one of 17 that was presented. And it was whittled down to 4, 3, 2, 1, and it was 3 months of rewrites, and Paula got it. So
and that's for the
theme
song for Liv and Maddie. Yeah,
yeah,
that was just amazing because the odds were completely against that happening.
Completely, and that was the only song I submitted. There were people that submitted 15 songs for that. That was a big cattle call for sure.
Yeah, not an inside job.
Not an inside job.
So, what does it mean to be a music publisher?
Well, a music publisher has changed over the years. In its early days, in its infancy, and we'll call that the 70s and 80s.
70s and 80s. Now I'm feeling old.
We'll call that the 60s. We'll go as far back as the 60s, 70s,
80s. 50s, 40s.
Publishers historically have two main functions. They sign songwriters and they sign catalogs of songs. So you could sign the Marvin Gaye catalog, for example. So it could be a deceased songwriter. But the publisher's job is to nurture their living songwriters and nurture their catalogs of songs, meaning exploiting in a good way commercially to develop a songwriter's career, get songs recorded by artists, get songs placed in film and television, and basically you're kind of like a manager and a supporter and a developer of songwriter. You are a nurturer of songwriter and catalogs. Nowadays, it's a lot different. It's a lot more challenging. They still have that job. Oh, the other thing that publishers do is They administer and they do all the paperwork and they collect all the money for the songwriters and for themselves. So when songs are played on the radio, when you hear songs on airplanes, in grocery stores, people performing them live, songs that are sold, still downloads, all that money needs to be collected. Streaming, everywhere you hear or buy or pay for music, publishers are collecting. So they have an infrastructure around the world in order to collect for all the different territories. So they have a creative arm and they have an administrative arm with regards to songs and songwriters. That's what they do.
The perfect place to ask the question about what in the world do BMI and ASCAP do? Because right. When you say BMI and ASCAP, I think, okay, that has something to do with tracking, at least tracking, maybe also collecting, yes. I don't know, royalties for people that would get royalties for music, whoever yes. that might be, songwriters, it is producers.
It is for songwriters and publishers only. BMI and ASCAP, they both do the same thing. They do it only in America. They collect performance royalty income in America. In France, SACEM. In Canada, SOCAN. In Germany, GEMA. Every country has one performing rights society, PRS. America has two, really three. CSAC is the third. That's kind of like the little baby ASCAP BMI. But for all intents and purposes and for this conversation, ASCAP and BMI do the same thing, but in America, we're the only country that has competing performing rights societies. Every other country has one.
Is there any, like, genuine difference between them, or are they just sort of, like, different flavors of the same?
They're different flavors of the same. However, and Dove and Ryan are a perfect example of ASCAP and BMI, two different companies that do, not essentially, but do the same thing. And whenever you're going to go into business with a company, especially if there's two or three different companies that do the same thing, the most important thing is the people that you meet with and the people that you have a connection with. And so Dove is a perfect example. We went to ASCAP first and we left and I was like, Yeah. I don't say anything. Yeah. I felt it. I said, what do you think? We leave the building. You never discuss anything, even when you're in the elevator, until you leave the building. And didn't feel right. We went to BMI, and just sitting in the meeting with Barbara Kane, I was like, oh, done deal. We left there. Dove looked at me. I looked at her. I go, you don't need to say anything. I know what you're going to say. So ASCAP and BMI do the same thing. What they do is they have this crazy system somehow, which I don't know if anybody in the world understands it, even people who work there. but they collect performance royalty income. So anytime a song is performed, I'm making quotes right now, performed, meaning in public, you hear it on the radio, again, you hear it in any public place, licenses have been created and money stream happens. BMI and ASCAP collect the money stream and they pay directly to the songwriter, and they pay directly to the publisher. That's all they live to do.
So they collect right and they pay, collect and distribute.
They do not collect money for mechanical royalty income. There are two different types of royalty income as far as a songwriter and an artist is concerned, and a producer. There is performance royalty income and mechanical royalty income. Performance is what I've just explained. Anything that you hear live, radio, television, outside in the world, in public, in a restaurant. You're hearing music in a restaurant, somebody is paying for that. That restaurant is paying a monthly fee or a quarterly fee to ASCAP and BMI to play whatever they want. Mechanical royalty income, the second flow of income, is for downloads. It used to be when people bought albums. It used to be when people bought CDs. Now, it's a download. And it's a different type of income, but it's something that the buyer owns. Streaming is this mix of the two that has caused all kinds of problems in the songwriter world in terms of making a living.
Yeah,
that's
a whole other conversation.
That's a whole other conversation.
We actually talked about that with Shelley Pikin.
Yeah, she's at the forefront of the mission to change some very, very old, outdated laws that are negatively affecting the songwriter's ability to make an income and to have a career being a songwriter.
Well, that's perfect, because that leads us right into my next thought, which is, you know, the fact that the landscape of the music business has changed so much since you started in this business, mm-hmm. and it's literally changing as we speak here. Are there any stories you'd like to share about that, about just the kind of crazy changes that you've seen over the years?
I think the most significant changes that everyone can agree with that has affected every songwriter in America is that the streaming has taken over the method by which most users listen to and watch music, whether it's through YouTube or Pandora or Spotify or any of the various streaming companies, Google. Many, many years ago, a songwriter, just a working songwriter, could make a living and never have a hit single. They can have songs recorded on 100 different artists' albums and do very, very, very well. Now, that has completely changed. The landscape has changed in the sense that the consumer doesn't buy music anymore like they used to. They didn't have a choice in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and even up into the 90s. You had to buy an album or a CD in order to hear the music that you wanted. And now you don't have to do that anymore. So kids grow up kind of thinking music is free. And even if you have a Spotify $9.99 per month subscription, you're getting a lot of bang for your buck there, and the songwriters are really taking the hit for it. So the biggest change is that you really can't make a living being a songwriter getting songs recorded by artists anymore. There's a very few. The Diane Warrens of the world are one in a billion now.
Well, and I have heard, too, there's a kind of conventional wisdom right now that the only way to even really make a living as a performer is by touring and selling merchandise.
Yeah.
Because you know, selling tickets are at least something, ticket sales,
yep.
and you get a big chunk of that,
yep.
hopefully. And then t-shirts and all the other various merchandise, like that's
yep.
that's about almost the only way that performers, singers
yeah.
can possibly make a living.
Now the other way that songwriters, performers can also make a living is when you do stream videos and when you do stream the songs that you own the masters. This is the difference. The songwriter, if they're only a songwriter, they don't own the master, they own the song. But the master owner is the person who owns the recorded version of that particular song. If they own it, the streaming rates on the master side not only quadruple, they 10 times, they 15 times, they 30 times what the songwriter earns on that same play.
So who owns the master is who's going to make any money, basically,
yes.
off of a song.
And if you sign a record deal, the record company pays to make your album, typically, traditionally, and still today. The record company gives you a little bit of an advance to live, and they pay for your album, to record it, to hire the producer, to pay for the studio, to pay for the mixer, to pay for the master, so they own it. So the record company generates all that income, and they make all that income because they own the master. But if you're young and you're multi-talented and you can create your own, write your own song, produce your own song, and own the master, and own the video that you make, you have a much better chance of creating some valuable income for yourself.
And maybe making a living out of it.
And maybe making a living. Yeah.
That's happy news.
That is happy news. There are some outlets. They're just fewer and farther between and just more challenging.
This is perfect. So that's basically who's making some money in music these days is the multi-talented people who then manage to own the masters
yes.
to their own work.
Yes.
Anybody else making money in music these days?
Songwriters struggling like never before. Producers are making a living because they're getting paid up front. They're getting paid a fee to do a job. It's the back-end royalty income that is the most challenging for the songwriters, the producers, and the artists as well on some levels. But the producers are still surviving because the record companies need them, and they get paid up front. They are doing a job, and they get a fee Producers also get a producer royalty on record sales, but again, that has dwindled substantially.
So the record companies, though, they're making money with all the streaming services. They're making the bulk of it, right?
Yes. Did you talk about that with Shelley?
A little bit.
They really, from what I understand, don't quote me on this, but from what I've heard from several people over the last few years, is that Google and some of the major streaming companies did deals far in advance with the record companies, paid them literally tens of millions of dollars to be able to stream the rights, to be able to have the rights to stream the master recordings, because the record companies own the master recordings. Everyone from Fleetwood Mac to Prince to Bruce Springsteen to, you know, Beyonce and beyond. Google and the big, very, very wealthy tech companies did these deals in advance with the record companies so that they would then be able to stream the masters, pay the record companies, and the publishers came late to the party. And the pie of income that generates was taken up already. Mm-hmm. So there was just a teeny tiny sliver left for the publishers. It's a tragedy for the publishers and the songwriters, what's happened. But there are young people and old people that are fighting the good fight. And trying to change history right now.
Yeah, and change the laws.
And change the laws.
What has to happen.
Yeah.
So if you were talking right now to an aspiring music artist or an aspiring young producer, what advice would you give them?
Well, the advice, oh my gosh, it's tough, because you don't ever want to quell anyone's pursuits and dreams and the vision that they may have for themselves. But like I said in the beginning of this interview, you really do need to be a multi-talented individual on many, many levels, both as a creator and a bringing to fruition the creation that's in your brain, both with technology and being a mindful, studio-experienced person. I think, let's use Dove as an example. Dove is a multi-talented young person. And when I first got involved with her, the manager that I was talking to, do we have time?
Yeah, we're good. Okay.
The manager and I came up with an idea long before we met Dove, which was, hey, I like you, you like me, you're music, I'm film and television, let's try to find a young person who can do it all. Because you got to be able to do it all nowadays. I mean, look at Justin Timberlake. He's a perfect example of an actor, a writer, a singer, a dancer, a multi, you name it. And so this manager made that initial suggestion, and we were both kind of, you know, keeping our eyes open for that person. He happened to stumble across Dove. And so the idea was, great, let's see what takes off first. And if TV takes off, maybe then she can get enough exposure and we can start the music thing, and you can work both talents off of each other to benefit the artist in general. And that is what happened with Dove. Dove got to LA, started off her career just kind of was not only unique, but extraordinary. And now she has a lot of choices and she can do lots of things depending on whatever it is that she wants to do. That doesn't happen to everybody. However, if your talent is there and you have the intelligence and charisma and confidence and downright bull in a china shop, I'm going to get there no matter what it takes. You have to have that. I don't care how many no's I get, I'm going to keep going because I know I'm good. You have to have that kind of integrity as well, too. And as much as you can, surround yourself by people who do have experience so you can learn from them. Both on the studio side, I'm on the studio side, and on the creative side. Soak up as much as you can, especially in cities like LA and New York. There are resources like crazy, but then it really does come from within. And sometimes when you have a mom like Dove does, that doesn't hurt either. But someone to help you, someone to stretch, you know, to reach out and acknowledge. If you can get to industry creative executives on some level, part of their job, part of our job is to recognize talent. And if I can't do that, I'm not going to have a career. So, as a young, talented, creative person, you have to get on the radar because it is a music business. If you want to make a career, you have to meld the two. So, how's that?
It's good. How do you get on the radar? I'm just going to ask the question that I know every young aspiring singer, songwriter, person out there has. Like, okay, well, that's nice. How do you get on somebody's radar? How do you get on the radar of people who can help you?
Yeah. Okay. I just, two great examples. School and education, a college is a great example. I just met a young kid. He's 21 years old. He went to Berklee for a semester.
So this is Berklee School of Music in Boston.
Berklee School of Music in Boston, B-E-R-K-L-E-E. And maybe he was there a year, but definitely less than a year. And there was a young woman named Cara Diaguardi, who you may or may not know. She was an American Idol judge for two seasons, but she was a huge hit songwriter. Very, very successful. She did a semester or two at Berklee where she was teaching and she was guest appearing. And this kid happened to be in a class that she was guest appearing. And he just busted in and made himself visible to her and connected with her and got her his music. He was 16 when she first met him at Berklee, and she liked him.
Wow.
And she stayed in touch. And it's 4 years later, and he's moved to LA about 6 months ago. And now I've met him through her, and I'm excited about him and talking about signing him. So one of my writer producers, a very talented man by the name of Smitty.
Oh, I love Smitty.
He now is spending some time at USC. And so if you go to USC, if you have the opportunity to have a class, some kind of musical education, whether it's in LA, USC, UCLA, community colleges as well, Berklee in Boston, in New York, there's many, many colleges. The people who are teaching those courses are either currently active in the music business or have been, and they all know people. So I would highly, strongly recommend that some type of extensive education can help you because those people can be a hand to introduce you to other people in the business.
That is great advice. And then in terms of like, is it important to live in LA? What about New York and Nashville?
Absolutely. Those three cities for sure. Even Austin, Texas, to a certain extent. Nashville has become more and more diverse over the last decade.
And not just country, right?
Yeah, in terms of not just country. Loads of pop songwriters and producers have moved to Nashville. So Nashville is a great resource. You can move down there a lot cheaper than you can certainly in New York and even in LA. But those three cities are definitely just, and LA and Nashville even more. LA number one, Nashville number two, New York number three in terms of how much activity I think is there. New York is so expensive. Real estate is so expensive that, I don't know, maybe about 12 or 13 years ago, there was literally a mass exodus. People just could not afford to live in Manhattan anymore. And so they came to LA and they went to Nashville. So a lot of talent in all of those cities.
So I've always been curious, how did you get involved in this industry? Like, this is an unusual thing to do. How did you fall into it? Did you always know you wanted to be in the industry?
No, I didn't. Quick background is my grandpa was a music publisher. My dad was a music publisher. I kind of come from somewhat of an iconic music publishing background, which is really cool and great. But growing up, I kind of rebelled against it. And when I was in college, I went to the non-Berklee School of Music, but Berklee in Northern California. And it wasn't until I was a senior, I think, that I decided what I wanted, that, oh my gosh, I have to go into music because I can't get it out of my brain. And I'm driving all my friends crazy. I can't listen to the radio without knowing who sang that song. Why doesn't the DJ ever say the name of the artist? So I rebelled against it. And I thought that because my family was kind of famous in the music business, everybody would think that I took the easy way out. I thought, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to start from the bottom like everybody else. So I did an internship. There was A&M Records in San Francisco, South San Francisco. I did an internship there. There was a record store in Oakland, California, called Rainbow Records. I got a job at Rainbow Records. I was the accessories manager. And then I moved to LA, and I got, after 6 months of just interviewing, I got a job as a secretary at a record company. I was making $17,500.
Oh my God.
A year. So I took a job at the Central, now known as the Viper Room, to be a cocktail waitress, to make extra money, and hear music.
That's perfect.
And so I thought, I'm starting at the bottom. And then one day, when I'm a big-time music executive, nobody handed it to me. And so it's a different day. There's no record stores anymore. You know, there's record company internships. I guess you can still do that.
Mm-hmm.
You can. That still exists. But so I think even though I had some certainly good advice along the way, I think I started like anybody else would. Any ordinary person in college or outside of college would just figure out a way to get in somewhere where you can hear music and be in the music industry and do a crappy job for a crappy boss as their secretary and can't wait till a better job comes along. And so I think I put my time in, but that's how I started.
So were there ever times when you called your dad for advice? And
oh yeah, I did. He was fantastic. He was the best guy ever. And I always hoped I would work for him one day. I always wished that he would hire me. My dad was not the guy that would give me a job because I was his daughter. My dad, in fact, I was working in publishing for 9 years. 7 years at Rondor, 2 years at BMG. Creative jobs. My dad calls me one day, and he's working at DreamWorks now. He started DreamWorks Music Publishing. He'd been there for a year.
He started DreamWorks?
Yeah.
Music. Okay.
So he calls me up. He says, hey, so listen, so I've been at DreamWorks for a year, and I need a creative person now. You know, I've got a couple writers. I got a couple catalogs. Anybody, you know, can you make a recommendation? And I was like, really? Yeah. Think about it. Let me know. Okay, gotta go. So that's my dad. And I hang up, and I'm like, wow, he didn't ask me. I've been in publishing for 9 years. I call him back. Dad, so did you think about me at all for this job? What? Tell me a little bit more about it. Me? He goes, yeah, I thought about you, but I have some reservations. And I'm like, okay, hold back the tears right now. Oh my God, okay. He goes, listen, you think about it. If it's something you really want to pursue, call my secretary and make a breakfast and we'll have breakfast and we'll talk about it. I'm like, okay, hang up.
Oh, jeez.
Oh my God, my dad has reservations. So I type out a list. I typed it on a computer, printed it out, why he should hire me, what I'm good at, what I'm not good at, positives, negatives, blah, 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 blah. We have breakfast. I give him my lists, do my thing. I get the job. He hires me at DreamWorks. His reservations were, you're at BMG. You've got a contract. You're doing great. You like your boss. He likes you. BMG is a solid, substantial, not going anywhere company. DreamWorks is Steven Spielberg, Jeffrey Katzenberg, David Geffen on the music side, Mo Austin on the music side, all these big names, all this fat cat money. He said, we could go belly up in 2 years.
It was brand new at that time.
It was brand new at that time. And he said, if you choose to take this on and we go belly up, you could have stayed at BMG. That's my reservation.
Aww.
So I was like, oh, Dad was looking out for me. All right, that's cool. And so I worked with him for 7 years until the company sold. And after the company sold, that's when I went out on my own.
So, that's perfect.
Yeah.
So you got to work with your dad.
I did. And he was the best boss ever. He was awesome. He gave great advice. He didn't treat me like a daughter. I called him Chuck. I didn't call him Dad, ever. And he was very fair, and he was the best publisher in the world.
So Chuck K.
Chuck K. Yeah. Look him up.
We'll let good anybody one. Look him up who's good curious one. To see what amazing people he has represented.
Yeah, he was a good one. I got lucky.
Well, that's a great story. Yeah. That's a great way to get started in a business that you clearly were meant to be in.
Oy. Right?
So, Molly, how can people find you? You are not super active on social media.
That's where I saw it. No. I know, I'm ashamed.
You're busy working.
I'm busy, actually.
I get it.
And every time I go on to social media. I'm like, I'm wasting my time here.
You're not fooling around.
Stuff to do.
I know.
So people can find me at bmajormusic.com, my website. You can see the clients that I represent. You can reach out to me there and get a sense of the types of things I'm doing right now, that I'm involved with right now. And that's how you can find me.
That's great. Thank you so much, Molly.
You're welcome. Yay! That was fun.
Thanks for listening to Hometown to Hollywood. If you like what you heard here, subscribe to this free podcast and leave a quick rating and review. A moment to click on a star rating really helps, and a minute to write a sentence-long review makes a real difference in the ranking for this podcast. Thank you so much for helping me. Do you want to know more about getting a young actor up and running in Hollywood? Buy my book, The Hollywood Parents Guide, on Amazon. And if you need specific help getting your career or your child's career up and running or to the next level, you can get a one-on-one consultation with me over Skype or in person in Los Angeles. Go to my website, hollywoodparentsguide.com, and click on the consultations page. Thanks, and see you next week.